On Tuesday, May 28th, we celebrated National Hamburger Day by talking to an author who has a new book out about where the hamburger actually came from. The answer may surprise you. Hartford Current columnist and blogger Kevin Rennie also joined us to talk about what's going on at the state capitol. And Scott Shepard stopped by from the Yankee Institute to talk about some little-known facts regarding the governor's toll proposal.
Well, I bet you didn't know. Bet you didn't know that today's National Hamburger Day. Tuesday, May 28th, a lot of you folks, if you had family gatherings over the Memorial Day weekend, you may have grilled up a few burgers here and there. And joining us right now, I couldn't say no to this one. It was offered to me. Christopher Carosa, author of Hamburger Dreams, How Classic Crime-Solving Techniques Help Crack the Case of America's Greatest Culinary Mystery. And let's punch him up right here. Chris, hi. Paul in Bridgeport, you're on WICC. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Happy National Hamburger Day to you.
You too, my friend. It is a delicacy that I probably started eating in the womb. I can tell you that much. But, yeah, Hamburger Dreams, How Classic Crime-Solving Techniques Help Crack the Case of America's Greatest Culinary Mystery. Now, your website, we'll give that up front, hamburgerdreams.com. Why did you choose, Chris, to become a hamburger sleuth here?
I did not choose it. It chose me.
Oh, here we go.
I was a senior in college, had to write a paper about my hometown of Buffalo, New York.
Yeah.
In the process, I discovered that right outside the city, actually the town I was in, was from, was the place that they invented the hamburger.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. It's not Louis Lunch in New Haven?
Well, I was going to say, I was at Yale.
Yeah.
And I immediately told my classmates that. And one of my classmates was a native of New Haven. He says, no, they didn't. They invented it here. And he promptly took me to Louis Lunch.
Okay.
So that's where I was first introduced to this idea that there were competing stories.
Ah, so in your college years, so you're telling me now you were a young man, you were conflicted. Is that what you're saying?
I was conflicted. I was curious, actually, more than that. And then I forgot about it for about 35 years.
So it wasn't something that was burning in your gut, no?
No. I actually wrote another book called 50 Hidden Gems of Greater Western New York when I revisited the story.
Yeah.
This is a 2012 book.
Uh-huh.
And during the book tour for that story, I told some stories from the chapters of the book, I should say. And this was one of the stories that captivated the audience. So I decided, you know, maybe I should do a little bit more research, dig in, try to separate fact from myth, and see what I come up with. And what I came up with was Hamburger Dreams.
All right. So, and you know, when people, I mean, yeah, they cheer for their hometown sports teams too, Chris, but, you know, they take pride in the fact that their hometown may have been the originating spot of something that's now nationally famous.
In fact, all four stories, five if you, or six maybe, if you include the sister cities involved with two of the stories,
yeah,
they all do have festivals regarding the hamburger and the invention of the hamburger being associated with that city. And at one point, I think I wrote a chapter, the title is, you know, I Hate to Rain on Your Parade, one of those things. But, you know, at the end of the book,
yeah.
At the end of the book, and this is not a spoiler or anything, but yeah. It's kind of like philosophically how I feel about it. I tell a story about how I was at a Boy Scout campground, and I was a leader, and I had to show the boys how to cook breakfast and eat breakfast. So I showed them how to make pancakes, how to make eggs.
Christopher Carosa, a Yale grad, award-winning writer, contributor to Forbes.com. And we should mention that Chris, back in 2018, elected president of the National Society of Newspaper Columnists for a two-year term. New York Press Association's 2018 Better Newspaper Contest awarded him honorable mention in the Best News and Feature Series for the series of articles he wrote, yes, that form the basis for Hamburger Dreams. So you were telling us, Chris, about the time you were a scout leader and were showing the little boys, as my son was once in scouting, how to cook breakfast.
Sure, pancakes and eggs. And I decided after I was done with the boys, when it was my turn, I didn't want to have to dirty up my utensils. So I took a couple of pancakes, made an egg, put the egg in the middle, and created a sandwich out of these pancakes and the eggs. And everyone was amazed, and they made some for themselves. They were so excited. I invented a new breakfast sandwich. Well, in fact, 5 years earlier, McDonald's had invented the McGriddle.
Oh, I remember that.
I was not aware of. So I just reinvented with something that was already invented. And so these stories, even though they're different years and, you know, may one of them's the first, but the other one's not, they could all represent that same sort of creative insight that was independent of one another, and people just came up with the idea of something like a hamburger, period.
All right, give us now, you went on this little debate after you graduated from Yale with a friend of yours, and you put it aside, you said, for 30-something years, and then you came back to it, and you were writing, you know, these articles you were awarded for. So take us to the genesis of these articles. What was one of your early discoveries on this, Chris?
Well, the basis of how I had to approach it was a challenge, because there was no contemporary report that said, "Hey, guess what happened today? Somebody invented the hamburger."
So the New York Times, it wasn't up front page above the fold on the New York Times.
No, it wasn't even on page 36 or 63 or whatever. It wasn't reported at all. All the stories, all four stories, did not come into being until decades after the events actually occurred. So you're dealing with perhaps different sorts of memories that people had, maybe some exaggerations, not just on the part of the storytellers, but on the journalists and proponents of the story. So I had to kind of sift through all that. And the way I decided to approach it was not like so much an investigative reporter, well, yeah, maybe a little bit like that, but more like a detective. And so I used these crime-solving techniques going way back when to like Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, one of the things that Sherlock Holmes did is he always sought to eliminate the impossible. So he has all the suspects lined up, and clearly some of the suspects could not possibly have committed the crime. So I did the same thing with these four suspects.
Yes.
I divvied them up by year, and I decided, okay, let's go back to the contemporary news articles and find out the earliest mention of the hamburger sandwich, or what we call now a hamburger sandwich, what they probably called back then a hamburger sandwich.
Yeah.
And anything that was any origin story that occurred after the earliest date in the newspaper could not possibly have been true, because they were already selling hamburgers by the time these stories were supposedly to occur.
Got it.
So unfortunately, New Haven loses in that. New Haven story is a 1900 story.
Yeah.
The earliest I was able to find was 1893, 1894, and they were selling these hamburgers. It wasn't even like a casual sort of thing. They were actually pretty popular. I saw menus, newspaper advertisements from the late 1890s with menus, hamburgers on the menus, hamburger sandwich or hamburger sandwiches on the menus.
So you're saying Louis Lunch, even you, a former, well, yeah, I guess you're always a Yale man. I don't want to say former because somebody will strike me down if I say that. You, even a Yale man, you know, for God, for country, and for Yale, that you have just struck down a major myth in my upbringing.
Well, yeah, unfortunately. I mean, I know the story, and actually talk about the story of the Lassen family and how they, you know, helped promote this idea.
Yeah.
And it's very honorable, for the least of which reasons is that Ken Lassen was taking on City Hall.
Yes.
And that's the kind of story that you don't want to really put down. That's a legacy in of itself.
Okay, so we'll scratch. So it's great stuff. Don't ever ask for ketchup. You know that. But so Louis Lunch is off the list. Okay, continue.
I should add one thing, since you mentioned the ketchup.
Yeah.
When I'm on these interviews across the country, I tell them that story.
Oh.
Yeah, because they always say, well, was ketchup always part of the hamburger from the beginning?
Oh, no,
well,
no.
Well, if you go to Louis Lunch, no.
No, they'll throw you out of the place if you ask for ketchup.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we had, there's another story that was popular. In fact, this came about because of the Louis Lunch story. Louis Lunch was in the New York Times because of the battle that they were going through.
Yep.
And Clint Murchison Jr., the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, was shown this story and told a Dallas news reporter, "This isn't true. My grandfather told me that a guy from Athens, Texas, invented the hamburger at the St. Louis Fair, on the Pike of the St. Louis Fair." The Pike is the Midway.
Okay.
And this reporter, Frank Talbert, researched it and came up with all these intricate reasons why it was a true story. And the people went with that. There were a lot of newspapers reports that copied that story. But in fact, the whole St. Louis story was around for decades before the Athens, Texas story came into being.
Okay, so we're 0-2 now. Okay, I got it.
We're 0-2, yeah. Okay. So that leaves two stories, both from 1885.
Yeah.
One in Seymour, Wisconsin, which was in October of 1885, and the other in the, Buffalo, New York, the Erie County Fair, which is actually, you're going to like this one, in the town of Hamburg, New York.
Ah.
That's where the Erie County Fair was held.
Got it.
It continues to be held. And this is an important part of the story because of the way they tell it. Well, we'll talk about the Wisconsin one first. Mm-hmm. The Wisconsin story, again, it occurred a month later, so if they're both true, then obviously the Erie County Fair story was first. But what I was able to find was the here's how I did it.
Okay.
I had to get the facts from each of the stories. And the facts, again, were told decades later. And this, in the case of Wisconsin, almost 50 years after the fact.
Hmm.
And this is how the story was told. Charlie Negreen, who had been selling these hamburgers for supposedly 50 years now, told a story to the reporter in the local newspaper that the first year he attended the first Seymour County Fair and sold his hamburgers there, which were squashed meatballs between bread, went to the New London Fair that wouldn't let him in there. Then he, on his way to the Oshkosh Fair, he lost the $10 that he made in Seymour. $10, by the way, is a lot of money back then.
A lot of money back then, yeah.
So he lost it, and a good Samaritan helped him. He went to Oshkosh, and he sold his hamburgers there, and the rest is history. So he tells this story 49 years later in the newspaper. 2 weeks after that newspaper article printed his story, the person who found, I forgot to say that, Charlie Negreen said, on my way back from Oshkosh, some guy gave me the $10 that I lost. He had found it, and I don't remember the guy's name. Well, so 49 years later, 2 weeks after the story comes out, the newspaper prints a letter to the editor from this 81-year-old farmer who says, hey, I'm the guy who found the $10.
Okay.
So that sounds like good corroboration.
Corroboration, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I dug a little further. And I found out when these fairs occur, just to make sure that the sequence was correct.
Okay, and hang on, Chris. We're getting close, folks. We started with four possible origins of the hamburger. We're now down to two. The tension mounts. The tension builds. Christopher Carosa, MBA, author of Hamburger Dreams, How Classic Crime-Solving Techniques Help Crack the Case of America's Greatest Culinary Mystery. Now, one more segment here with our guest coming off the Memorial Day weekend where a lot of folks might have chomped down on burgers. Name of the book is Hamburger Dreams, How Classic Crime-Solving Techniques Help Crack the Case of America's Greatest Culinary Mystery. Yale University graduate and noted columnist Christopher Carosa. Okay, Chris, so we are now down to two here, battling stories, as you said, from a couple of fairs.
That's right. So we're at the point now in the Wisconsin story to try to determine if the sequence of fairs as described in the original retelling of the Charlie Negreen origin story, if that sequence was actually in occurrence in 1885. So it starts with the first ever Seymour County Fair. And that, in fact, did occur in 1885. That's great. Next, he went to the New London Fair, except there was no New London Fair that year. And even worse, the Oshkosh Fair, which was third on the list, actually occurred before the Seymour Fair. So it looks like the sequence of fairs all mixed up. In fact, the first year where that sequence could have occurred would have been in 1891. Now, that's not saying he didn't invent the hamburger in 1885. And like I said, the story was almost a half century later. It just could have been that his memory wasn't, exactly. He mixed a couple of stories together.
Okay.
That could have been what happened. So that leaves us with the Erie County Fair story in Buffalo, New York. And there's a little bit of mixed up in that story, too, because in that early part of the 1900s, so this is, again, about 40 years after the story came out, an Akron reporter, the Menchus brothers were living in Akron, Ohio, and they were actually prominent businessmen in Akron at this point. A local business reporter decided to tell the story about how they invented the hamburger, but the story said they invented it at the Akron County Fair. And they gave some details of the story. And again, I go into those details and I find out the name of the butchers that they used didn't exist when they said they did. But however, at that time, when the story was written, they were prominent advertisers.
Ah.
So, So it made me think, oh. And now this story was repeated for several decades, even made Frank Mensch's obituary in 1951. Yet when I talked to the family had always heard that it was the Erie County Fair. And they tell me stories about how they would tell people in school when they were in elementary school about this, and they would be made fun of. It wasn't until 1970 when a circus journalist reporter came out with a book. In one of the chapters, it told the story about how the Mensch's brothers invented the hamburger at the Erie County Fair. And this was based on an interview from the 1920s. And I was able to confirm that, yes, this reporter and Frank Mensch's were in the same city at the same time. So it's probably true that this interview occurred. The person who introduced them was an actual person. All that worked. And then I went into the details of their stories. And the book will give you all the examples that I use, but there were a number of details that were confirmed by newspaper articles from 1885. So again, it's not a smoking gun, but it's probably as close to a circumstantial case as you can build that's most likely the true story. Now, here's the irony of this.
Yeah.
You know how today is National Hamburger Day?
Yes. Tell me, go ahead.
September 18th
is
National Cheeseburger Day.
Yes.
Based on the details of the story and the weather, because that's how detailed these stories were,
okay,
I pinpointed the exact date of the creation as September 18th, 1885.
Wow.
So what we celebrate as National Cheeseburger Day should be National Hamburger Day.
Uh-huh. Very good. So we've established then, as best you can, Frank Mensch's at the Erie County Fair in Hamburg, New York.
Wow. Frank and Charles Mensch's, they were brothers, they were commissioners, yes.
Wow.
So the thing that I do in this book, and it's great because if you have any question about the details, I've got like 300 reference notes. This is the scientist in me saying, you know, here's my proof.
What part of you, listen, there had to be part of you, Chris Carosa, who said, or maybe a loved one, a wife, a son, a brother, a friend who said, you're out of your mind. What are you doing this for? I mean, right? That had to happen at some point.
Of course it happened. You know, this is one of the, you know, I saw, and I've written a lot of other books, and primarily I'm writing in the financial industry. And those books, people buy those books a lot because they can make money on those.
But this was fun, right?
This was fun.
Yeah.
I went in a lot of different directions. Yeah. You know, I talk about how the chuck wagon was invented.
Oh.
In fact, that's part of the Louis Lassen story because he had a lunch wagon eventually in New Haven. And I talk about that whole evolution of that as a delivery vehicle for these hamburgers.
Wow. That's very, well, I tell you, I am honestly impressed with all the research you did here. I hope you've presented all this to the Smithsonian in Washington. I would hope so, Chris. Have you done that?
Oh, I never thought of doing that.
Oh, see, there you go. I'm telling you, I'm not kidding here, buddy. You got to tell them here is the, and let them go, let all their checkers go through it, and you'll have a hallowed place in American history. This is wonderful.
Sure, I'll do that.
Why not? Name of the book, Hamburger Dreams, How Classic Crime-Solving Techniques Help Crack the Case of America's Greatest Culinary Mystery. Christopher Carosa, I'm sure you can get the book everywhere. And Chris, you know, in some of the notes I have here, I'm really glad you did this because what do you pin this at? $1 trillion a year industry here?
Oh, yeah. Everyone's affected by the hamburger industry. Whether you work there or a family member works there or eat there, you're affected by it.
All right, Chris Carosa, Yale grad, go Bulldogs, go Blue, and we'll talk to you down the road, Chris. Thanks, appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, bye-bye. There you go, folks. So there it was. We finally got to the bottom of it, courtesy of Christopher Carosa. There it happened in Erie County, New York. He claims at the Erie County Fair, invented by Charles and Frank Mensch's. All right. Well, that shoots down a theory about my hometown in New Haven. I don't care. You go to Louis, don't ask for ketchup. A lot of folks weighing in on the first half of the first term, perhaps of two, of Governor Ned Lamont, one of those folks that I always read. And I read his columns in the Hartford Courant and also his blog, Daily Ruction. I just like saying the word ruction. It's Kevin Rennie, former state legislator, joins us. Hey, Kevin, Paul here. How are you, sir?
Hello, I am well, thank you.
Um,
for,
Excuse me? Oh, Kevin, I guess your agent didn't tell you you're going to be a regular here, but that's coming. Don't worry. couple things. You wrote an interesting piece I read a few days ago. Lamont's voice is hard to hear when he's surrounded by strangers. And you talked about the aura that Ned Lamont is trying to project here in so many different issues and brawls the General Assembly is having versus some of the people around him. I found it a very interesting read. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you that you found it interesting. I do think this is sort of a modern phenomenon in that with wealthy people who run for office, and then they don't have that kind of built-in infrastructure from previous campaigns. Ned Lamont had basically, abandoned, but the people who had been involved in his first two campaigns weren't involved in this campaign last year. He had a lot of new people, for the most part, a lot of new people. And, you know, people who hadn't been through the wars with him. And then when he got elected and he started hiring people, he hired a lot of people, it seemed, on recommendations from others. His chief of staff and his deputy chief of staff and, of course, the head of the Department of Economic and Community Development and others, I think, in his communications office. So these are people who they didn't know each other's instincts very well. And when you're involved in these high-pressure jobs, it's good to have people around you who just can kind of read the shorthand and know what your response to something is likely to be. I'm not saying make decisions for you, but it's just easier if everyone sort of understand each other well. And I don't think that I don't think he's built that kind of administration. He may not put a premium on that, but the people, members of the legislature, particularly the leaders, they've all worked together for many years. They have an understanding of one another that even though they understand they may have different goals and beliefs, it makes for a much easier working relationship when you know other people's limits.
And a few more minutes here with Kevin Rennie. He of the blog Daily Ructions and Hartford Current columnist. Kevin, before we had a break for traffic and weather there, you were talking about the kind of the disparity between the Lamont team. Has that harmed him? I mean, has that been a net negative for him, not having people who can kind of, you know, sports teams always say, you know, I knew where he was going on this, or just he gave me a head fake and I knew, you know, I knew what to do with the ball or the puck. Has that harmed the governor here?
Well, it seems like it's not like Kyle Lowry and Kawhi Leonard.
No,
that is for sure. So it is. One of my points was that just that the tone coming out of his communications office is kind of nasty and harsh. I don't think he's that way. I don't think that.
No, I agree with you. In the times I met him and talked to him, he's not that kind of a guy. I don't think. No.
No, he's really pleasant. You know, one of the problems is, and this is an overriding theme, is that we have had a series of governors who have not kept their fundamental promises, from Lo Weicker now to Ned Lamont. And Ned Lamont campaign, I'm not sure that his margin of victory was provided by his pledge of trucks only for tolls. But I think it made a difference, and I think he believed it was going to make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And then when he got into office, he abandoned that and now wants these tolls all around the state of Connecticut. And, you know, that's just a complete reversal of what he promised he would do. And I do believe that whatever party you are in, if you abandon the election promises you made just a few months ago, that there are going to be profound consequences with the public.
No, when you lose right, Kevin, we hear about that three-word phrase, the public trust, right? And when you lose the public trust or don't have anything, or you have any cachet built up in that, of course people are going to say, we don't trust you on tolls. We don't trust you on family and medical leave or a myriad of things.
Correct. I believe that by taking such a high profile issue and changing his stand on it in ways that, I mean, his explanations are not very good or credible. And everyone knew, anyone interested in public policy knew that how much trucks was a toll on trucks was likely to bring in, mm-hmm. and how much tolls on all motor vehicles would bring in. And it is no surprise that the tolls on all vehicles would bring in a lot more than tolls on just trucks. But he made a decision that he wanted the money. He wanted to win the election, and then he wanted the money that comes from tolls. And I think that it's really going to be follow him throughout his tenure as governor.
You know, Kevin, I and the guest is Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant. Also, check out his blog, Daily Ructions. That's Ructions. I love that word. I always have. I always will. I postulated, Kevin, before this election. I said, you know, and on shows like this, I said, you know, listen, if Ned Lamont wins, God bless him. I hope he is a raging success here that we will all tell our grandkids about. But I'm wondering whether the triumvirate of Joe Arisimowitz and Bob Duff and Marty Looney are kind of licking their chops at the aspect of him winning. And if they kind of, you know, people said, well, what do you think? And I think, well, I thought the three big leaders would sit him down and say, you know, Governor, congratulations, welcome to the Capitol, and this is how it works up here.
I don't think we live in an era where you would do that. I think that they're sort of doing it issue by issue. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, issued a call to come and see him. He said, don't criticize me in public. Come and see me and talk to me. That has not worked. Mm-hmm. And the tone coming out of his office is nasty from his communications people. I think some of his staff members are unpleasant to legislators, and this is not what they expected. If this is what they had expected, well, then they would have adjusted. But I do think it's a surprise, and they're taken aback, and they have a thousand ways that legislators can retaliate and let Ned Lamont know who's in charge, or I shouldn't say who's in charge. That they have some power.
What do you think of the Republican response to all this, in particular, Len Fasano and Themis Claridis and Kevin Kelly and some of the leadership up there? Is it all they could do to just, hold daily press briefings and news conferences, or is there another way here, or is this just what happens when you're in the minority party?
Yes, very hard. It is very hard. I think it's tedious. Frustrating, particularly in the Senate, where they had an 18-18 division in the last term, and with some moderate Democrats were able to have some remarkable legislative victories. But now they don't have that, so they are they haven't been able to do a lot. They can shine a light on some of the things that are going on, but in the last 3 days of the session, which begin on Monday, they have a lot of power because they can run the clock out. And also, I think some of the days this week will be spent on a budget. Mm-hmm. So that will make it even harder for other bills that are on the calendars of the two chambers to be considered.
You know,
if you can easily run down 2 hours of debate.
Oh,
on
yeah,
bill.
Yeah. Kevin, the state Democratic Party here seems to be reflective a little bit of what's going on nationally, where the centrists, and they are there, they tend to get outshouted a bit by those on the left. And you mentioned the budget. We're starting to see that with the governor saying, well, really don't want to raise taxes. Hello. But, you know, you've got some far progressives here who keep banging the drums for at least a higher index of income tax on the wealthier folks in the state.
Yes. I mean, there are... we're sort of reaching, I think, we may, people leaving. Mm-hmm. We've reached a point where these marginal increases are having a disproportionate effect on people's decision making, because they're already paying a lot of money to live in Connecticut. You add to that, and then it becomes an economic and sort of a cultural is not the right word, but quality of life issue that, you know, you and I, we think the quality of life in Connecticut is great. Add an extra $10,000 a year, $5,000 a year. Well, and maybe the quality of life in North Carolina, maybe that's as good if you factor that in.
Yeah, the Outer Banks are looking better and better. Yeah.
Well, my feeling on tolls is that I'm not embarrassed that there is one tax, finally, one tax that Connecticut does not levy on its residents.
And one more segment here with columnist Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Current, also his blog, Daily Eruptions. Kevin, you started to talk about tolls here, and you were duly proud that we don't have them. Are we going to continue not to have them? What do you think?
I will be surprised if we don't get them in some form. I noticed in the governor's working draft of his toll bill, for instance, there is a train station for Bridgeport. And I have the list of the projects that are absolutely essential, according to the Department of Transportation. I think it's about $25 billion.
Yeah.
Nowhere on there is a train station for Bridgeport.
So at $300 million, yeah.
The auction has begun. And so that is, there's also one for Newington. So, I don't think it's $300 million, but this is what's going to happen to get votes. And the one reason the public is so skeptical about this is that we know that a lot of this money from tolls is not going to go from these essential projects that we're told have to be done because our bridges and roads are in such terrible shape. Mm-hmm. And I was just on the train on Friday, and I saw that Bridgeport already has a train station.
Yes, I go through it three times a week, yes.
So this is what's going to happen. This is not about – if there is a transportation emergency, this is not what it's about. And I think that there is are projects that absolutely need to be done. And
sure.
I do believe if the governor made a serious effort to say, this is what we need to do, this is first. For instance, you can put tolls on bridges. There are bridges that need to be replaced or repaired. Put tolls on those bridges. I do think drivers would understand.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, I've always said, listen, we put a man on the moon in 1969. I know there are some people that don't think that, but they don't count. I said, listen, in this day and age, we have the technology, you know, to set up a website. It says, okay, the three tolls on the Sikorsky Bridge or on the P.T. Barnum Bridge. Well, today, those tolls brought in, you know, $600,000 or whatever. And we are going to dedicate that, like you say, to maintenance of this and that. People just want to know, Kevin, that the money they hand over is going to be used for that, not to plug a hole in the budget. And unfortunately, there's such a loss of faith here that it's really disheartening.
It undermines all these efforts. And the time is going to come when there are things that urgently need to be done, and a governor will need public support to accomplish them, and it will be withheld because our leaders are viewed as so untrustworthy, and that's what I worry about right now with the issue of tolls. Is that people just don't believe what they're being told, and they have reason not to believe it.
Yeah, Kevin. Final question: do you think, even though we're going into special session, they're going to do it ostensibly, you know, away from everything, and people can watch and keep up, do you think there might be enough squishy Democrats looking at the next year election in 2020 and looking at some of these special elections that have suddenly swung a few districts to the Republican side, might there be enough squishy D's to say, sorry, not happening, or not?
I would be surprised. It's possible. I think right now, obviously, they haven't voted on it because they don't have the votes.
Mm-hmm.
If they had the votes, they'd vote. But if they get to the point where they say we're going to call a vote, then you know that they have them, because the Democrats have really big majorities in the legislature. So if they should be able to round up the votes. You know, I hope it's not at $300 million a crack like they're doing it in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be good. But I do think they will find ways to entice people. And I do think those people, some of them will come to regret it, because I get the sense this is an issue that public opposition is being galvanized.
Yeah.
And I think there will be a price to pay. And I understand, and this is just what I've heard, I haven't seen it, but that polling that has been shown to some high-ranking state officials shows that voters are really opposed to tolling.
Wow. Okay. Well, Kevin, like I've been telling people, CTN is there on your cable system for a reason, or you can go online. So when they do this in July and August,
on your iPad.
Yeah, that's right. While you're lounging at the pool, you know, I pay attention. That's what I tell people, Kevin. Pay attention. Kevin Rennie from Daily Ructions and the Hartford Current. Kevin, good to talk to you again. We'll connect down the line.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Right. Appreciate it. Kevin Rennie, there you go. Former Republican state legislator and writes a rather. By the way, the blog, it's Daily Ructions, not Runk. RUCTIONS, Daily Ructions. .com. And like he said, yeah, pull up CTN wherever you are this summer and make sure just pay attention. Pay attention. And that's interesting. We got a little tidbit from Kevin there that they're polling. They're doing internal polling and people still don't like it. And why? What do we say, folks? Why? It's because they don't trust the General Assembly with the money. It's like trusting me with money in a camera store. It ain't going to be there when I leave. That's it. Or trusting me with money in a sporting goods store and I see those new New York Jets hats and team shirts. You know I'm walking out with something. You know it. Joining us right now, Scott Shepard. Writes one of the investigative reporters for the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. Scott, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm great. How are you?
Good. I read the Institute piece a couple of days ago, and you know, I've read so much on this whole toll issue, but this one kind of raised a few eyebrows with me because, as you folks at the Yankee Institute point out in the piece here, this is not as simple, Scott, as people make it seem. And you bring in the aspect of what, if any, say the federal government would have here. And a lot of people, I think, Scott, don't quite know that a state like Connecticut or anywhere else, we can't just do what we want to do with tolls here when, in fact, they do, affect interstate roadways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In order to toll federally supported roadways, we have to get the U.S. Department of Transportation's authorization and permission. And the only, if everyone agrees that the only effective program we could go in under is an anti-congestion tolling pilot program. And pilot's important there, too, because no state's ever attempted to do statewide tolling under this pilot program. And Connecticut doesn't have statewide congestion. We're a small state. We're a fairly urban state. But we've got the quiet corner. We've got plenty of parts of this state that aren't congested, and lots of parts of this state that aren't congested all day. So we're talking about something as though it's going to sail through with approval. And there's every reason to believe that very little of the governor's initial plan is going to get that approval, which means that every number that we've been told is right out the window.
So you're saying here, and I want to make sure people hear this. This is being sold, you're saying, to the feds as, well, we need this because of congestion, and the federal transportation officials may say, well, no, you really don't.
Well, that's right. They might say that some parts of it aren't necessary at all. I think we can agree that there's an area around Hartford that's congested for an hour or so in the morning and an hour or so at night, but that justifies a certain limited amount of tolling up here, but not all day long. You can't have the congested period and the non-congested period if there's no congestion at all for most of the day. And then if you only toll for a couple hours a day, that shoots the per dollar raised cost of construction and maintenance right through the roof. It also has been sold to us as a notion that the whole state is going to pay. This is a new revenue source, but we're all going to bear it. In fact, there could be a little bit for a few hours a day, as I say, around Hartford, and then you're mostly looking at that southwest corner. The southwest corner is congested a lot. It's congested on 95. It's congested on 15. But if those are the only parts that we can toll, then and the way the current tolling bill or the tolling bill they're going to start with in the special session is written, there's a fix on the price of tolls on the per mile cost for the first 3 years, and then they rise to whatever this congestion tolling program would require from the federal government, and anything that's needed to satisfy the obligations created when they bond out this tolling revenue. A lot of other states have gotten into a lot of trouble this way, assuming higher revenues than come in and then having to jack up the per mile toll rate just to extraordinary levels, way higher than initially promised. And Connecticut looks like it's headed down that road too.
You know, Scott Shepherd is the guest from the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. So what you're saying now makes a whole lot of sense to me, because before we spoke last week, I was reading from various sources, the PDF and other stuff online, and there was a one line here, Scott, that I did not understand, but I kind of thought it was what you just said. It's that line where it says, in the plan, the commission would set tolls at the lowest amount necessary to achieve congestion reduction. And I said to myself, well, wait a minute. That's the first I'm hearing of that. So you're telling me that my suspicion was right. This is all based on at least in some part, reducing congestion.
Yep. Well, it's not just that it has to be based in part on that. It's that we've got some experience in other states. Let me tell you, I used to live down in Northern Virginia.
Okay.
And you get out of the city of Washington and go out toward Dulles Airport on 66. And you come back in, of course, on 66 East. And part of that is now congestion tolling. There are times when going a few minutes on 66 costs up to $40
miles. I saw that. It was a story, actually, Scott, that made the national news last week. A lot of sites picked it up, that somebody had taken a picture saying that there had been on the message board $46.50. And I said to myself, you got to be out of your mind.
Yeah. Well, when they say, oh, this is a promise, 3 years at promised rates, and then the minimum necessary to achieve, and it's an or, it's not and, one or the higher of one or the other, either what's required for congestion or to satisfy the bonding that we've already done and what's necessary to keep these roads up. Well, that's no promise at all. That could soar, and it's almost certain to gallop above those numbers that are being used to sell the program to us now. That's no promise at all. It's just, it's more or less, it says the lowest possible, but it's more or less a guarantee of just soaring toll rates.
You know, Scott, and the other thing that bothers me too, and this whole thing, when you come right down to it, and you just mentioned it a few times here, and the supporters will admit this, that what we need to use this essentially as collateral. This is like somebody who needs a raise in their home income so they can qualify for another loan or a car loan or a loan to buy a summer home or a home equity loan. It's like, well, we don't have the income, so we have to squeeze it out of the taxpayers of Connecticut so we can bond like crazy.
That's right. That's right. And what they need is a new revenue source. They've talked an awful lot about these being user fees, but they want to use the revenue from tolls statewide, and the user's fees explanation doesn't make a whole lot of sense. They've just tapped out all their current revenue sources, and rather than admitting that and cutting costs everywhere they can and starting to live within their means, they've seized on this as a brand new, potentially very deep revenue source, and they're telling us anything that they think we want to hear right now to jam that through. And then once it's jammed through, once it's in place, all the bets and all the promises are going to be off, and they're going to soak that revenue source for everything that it's worth. And you know that that's true, because right now they're soaking us for everything they can squeeze out of us right now. The argument in the legislature isn't, is it good or is it right to raise the income tax further on the highest tax brackets, but can we possibly squeeze more out, or have we gotten so far down the road that we're driving everybody away?
Scott,
and that's the only analysis that occurs.
Scott Shepherd is the guest from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. A few more minutes here with Scott Shepherd from the Policy Corner at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Scott, the other thing that really gets under my skin here that people should know about is this transportation commission that would ultimately be entrusted with deciding how much to raise the toll rates, pretty much an unelected commission with an odd number of people, and the person obviously that would be appointed by any governor would be the tie-breaking vote here.
It's a situation where there's a lot of unelected vested interests. Presumably the governor is going to be ultimately responsible, but I would expect and hope that if some tolling system passed, that tolls could only be raised by the legislature with the concurrence of the governor, as though it were a tax bill, as mm-hmm. though, because that's exactly what it is. It's going to be a tax bill. What we'll have instead, though, is a commission where everybody can point at everybody else and say, well, the commission voted. I only have one vote on the commission, says the governor. The legislature, some of the leaders in the legislature have some appointments. There's some other constitutional offices. Everybody can point at everybody else and say that the initial statute requires that tolls be raised to a certain amount, and everybody can avoid responsibility. But the whole theory of representative government requires that when the state does something, we can point to the people who took the action and say, you voted for this, you voted against this,
yeah,
I'm able to hold you responsible. And they're on purpose trying to make that impossible.
In about the 30 seconds we have, Scott, what's your gut feeling on this as we go into a special session? What do you think ultimately happens?
Well, they pushed it into special session because they didn't have the votes. They can't make it work, and they can't pull the wool over our eyes. I would just ask your listeners to be very attentive and very engaged with all of their representatives right through mm-hmm. until the fall to make sure that they don't pull something when we're out on vacation.
Yeah, it's at that. Whenever you see July and August, that's exactly what they're trying to do. From the Policy Corner, the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Scott Shepherd. Scott, thanks, man. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Take care now.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, that's what, folks, why do you think it's in July and August? Better fire up that iPad around the pool.